Brainstorm Brewery is brought to you by GatheringMagic.com and CoolStuffInc.com. Show your support. So welcome everyone to another very special episode of Brainstorm Brewery. We're here at episode 115, somewhat of a milestone, I guess. I'm here with my three co-hosts.
Marcel, you're aware that this is episode 114, right?
No, this is 115.
We're so old we can't even remember how old we are.
Hey, how about we go to GatheringMagic.com? A great place to find Magic the Gathering podcasts and articles, GatheringMagic.com, brought to you by Cool Stuff, Inc. Why don't we go to that website and see what last week's episode number was?
That sounds good, Jason. Why don't you go do that for
I'm
us?
I'm actually on it. Last week's was 113, Stop Trying to Make Fetchtastic Happen.
Oh, that's why I did the Smoob Brothers and we did episode 14.
Yeah, you got wrecked.
What happened was Marcel got wrecked.
Oh, man.
You did get wrecked. Kid.
You did give me Corbin. I don't care. I'm not dealing with that.
Should call you Titanic because you just got wrecked.
Oh, my gosh.
Wow.
My heart will go on, but you won't go on being wrong because you got wrecked.
Oh, my goodness. I just can't recover from that. I'm just miles to stay sunk, be on the bottom of the ocean, get wrecked. But we got another voice here. You might have heard this voice before on the Spike feed. Excellent podcast. Actually, one of my favorite podcasts.
Appreciate that.
You guys have a good production quality. It's like top notch and you guys got good banter. So
that's all Cameron, man.
Hey, you guys do a good job. And they actually do, like, they got to synchronize their watches to get the editing right. Like, you know, they go above and beyond anything anyone else would do. But we got Dustin here.
What's up, guys?
What's good?
So welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. It's good to be here on 114 or 115. You never know, right?
Right.
Yeah, we brought Dustin along. In case people don't know, Dustin is the resident financial guy on the Spike feed. And he also does a lot of selling foreign cars. He goes to Japan often. And he's got a nice little trading cycle that he goes about. So we're going to pick his brain and dive into foreign cards for this episode. You get your 101, your 102, and a little bit more of that. So it's going to be a fun episode. And we also got spoilers because some of the good cards from Kanza Tycoon came out, or the bad cards, depending on how you look at it.
The indifferent card.
The set that has very controversy behind it. So what we're going to jump into first. What do you guys want to do? We're going to
Finance 101.
Oh,
man, I was thinking just get the spoilers over with, but whatever. Finance it is, right?
Yeah, but it's not your podcast, is it?
I'm following here.
Whoa.
Dude,
whoa.
You're also not handing out those IPAs. You're hoarding them all for yourself. I don't want to hear it.
See, Jason just got off a rant. I guess he did a stand-up comedy act, and he got booed off stage, so now he's trying to
Booed off stage, but it was my first time on stage, and the guy before me bombed, so I was like, oh, best conditions possible, but I won him back. It was a good night.
Awesome. Where was this at?
This was at a club no one's heard of because this is a national podcast. It was called Tip Top in Grand Rapids, Michigan. So that was a good time.
So are you going to make an extension to the top? Is this going to be your – have you got your good taste in and you tasted the blood and now you want some more?
You know what? I kind of wish I'd bombed my first time because I would be less enthusiastic about it than I am now. I'm already going to go back and do another set Friday. So, yeah.
We got
time.
YouTube videos of this?
Yeah, Jason's all in on his comedy career.
I don't think it'll ever go anywhere, but it's more fun than sitting home and talking to my wife, that's for sure. I'd rather talk about her on stage to strangers.
All right. I hope she's not listening to this podcast.
She doesn't.
She definitely won't.
All right. So, Dustin, let's dive into foreigns, and you're going to be our resident expert. We're going to rely on you.
All right.
That's not what the word resident means, by the way.
No, he is going to be our resident. Next time we got to get someone speaking on foreigns, he's going to come back, and he'll be our resident expert.
It's more like I'm a squatter, you know? I'm here until you guys just kick me out.
So tell us, basically, give us the You know, Finance 101 is the segment we do every week for people just to try to introduce some basic concepts. So why don't you go ahead and give people the Finance 101 explanation of just how foreign cards work compared to the English versions here in the United States.
Well, I guess we start with the basics, right? Foreign cards that are played in multiple formats, especially Legacy, some stuff in Modern, it just tends to be worth more. And as time goes by, they tend to continuously go up, even when the English counterparts kind of plateau out, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, where to start, right? You can easily... Yeah.
So how do people... how would somebody... First off, why do people like the foreign cards here?
So, okay, I think let's start with foils, right? If you had an English card and an English foil, the foil is considered the better version. Mm-hmm. Or it's considered the harder to get version. People like to have stuff that others don't. So to top the guy with the foil, you're going to go foreign or foreign foil. Because yours is even harder to get than his. It's just one of those things, right?
So people are there for the scarcity. That's what they're after.
It's not only the scarcity, but the bling as well. It's kind of like, you know, my Toyota Camry gets me where I need to go, but this other guy's got a Ferrari. It does the same job. His is just better and worth more. Makes sense?
That is a perfect comparison.
I mean, so, same cost too, right?
So what's, tell me this, as far as people getting a hold of these, how do people in the United States typically get the foreign cards who want them? You know, is this something you're just going to like come across at your local game store or what?
All right. So anybody that orders direct from Wizards of the Coast, of course, there's different tiers for different stores. They are offered foreign boxes, when new sets come out. I don't know exactly how many per tier, but one of my local shops, I want to say one of the bigger tiers, like a tier 3 or tier 4, and they can get one Korean box, one Russian box, a Chinese box, two Japanese boxes, and I think something like a French box. There's another store that's near me that gets German boxes, so on and so on. Anyway, the point is, the bigger the store, the more options they have. Not all store owners take advantage of this, so I would say that would be a good stepping stone right there. If you know the store owner and you go in there and he never has foreign boxes, say, I know you can order these. What will you sell them to me for? Because they get them at the same price as English boxes, which is something like, I think it's like $74 or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And you do see a lot on eBay. A lot of them probably just flip them instantly on eBay. Russian boxes sometimes on a good set are $120, $130 on eBay. So it's a much bigger markup for them. But like I said, smaller stores, if they can still get them, but they don't, I mean, there's no reason why you can't slip in there and say, look, dude, I'll give you $100 on a Russian box.
So what is the hierarchy? I know there's certain languages are more coveted than other languages.
So Russian and Korean are considered the two hardest to get and are typically worth the most, especially in foils. But Japanese tends to be the third hardest and most expensive, and it seems there's a lot more people that want Japanese. Korean cards, for me, are harder to get rid of. Especially in Asia, like nobody wants them over there, and here they're harder to get rid of. Whereas Russian cards, people want them, but the premium sometimes is so high they don't want to pay the price. Mm. So the Japanese cards kind of fit the medium where people will pay the extra, and more people just want them. Right? There's a bigger demand.
So what about working farther down that list? You know, Italian, Spanish, Chinese cards.
So if you look at the structures on like Star City and other websites, when they do happen to have Italian, French, Spanish, stuff like that, they're typically worth less, in non-foil. Sometimes the foils are worth equal to English, unless it's an older set or a really good card, then it could be higher. That being said, in trade, there's never been a time when I can't get rid of a French card or Spanish card for even a dollar more than an English counterpart. Just because it is harder, you don't find those people. And you see a lot of people here domestically that had taken French or Spanish in high school, so they want those cards just because it's kind of got like a little bit of a nostalgia to them, or they can read it and they just think it's kind of cool.
I would say the big exception is when the name is funny.
With the German cards?
Or early French too, like the French delays ones. Retard, like people like Übermeer in German or Jägermeister of the Fells and stuff like that.
Right. That makes a lot of sense. People like anybody will grab those just because they're awesome, right?
Exactly. Okay, so I mean, and I think that leads into kind of the next point we want to hit on the 101 here, is that these cards aren't for everybody. You know, the people who want them, Right. And the people who don't want to pay more for them. So how do you, you know, kind of strike the balance between, between the two there?
Well, first off, don't go to Minneapolis. It's just not happening.
Just right? In general, probably, right?
You might be safe by doing that.
Right. So the markets are different from city to city. Like whenever I go to Indianapolis, I always find people that are wanting the Japanese and Japanese foils. It's not a problem. Some people, like, if they're looking for something and you have it, but they can't find it from another trader, they'll take it in Japanese and they'll pay the extra, you know, dollar, $2 here and there just because they're trying to get their deck together, right? It's when the foils are the really, really big thing here. So most foreign cards, including Japanese, if it's a rare and it's under $20, it's usually within a dollar of its English counterpart. Once it gets to the higher point, it might be $2 to $5. It also depends if it's rare or mythic. But once it becomes a foil and it's playable, especially multi-format playable, that's where we're seeing like 3 to 4 times the amount of an English foil. Mm-hmm. And those people are harder to find. Typically, it goes to EDH players or legacy players. They love pimping stuff out, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So yeah, and I mean, I think kind of tailing along with the same thing, one thing to note is that if you decide as a player that you're interested in these cards, and you start to accumulate some, you know, more power to you, that's awesome. You can sometimes run into trouble if you get to where you need to sell them and you're trying to sell to a buy list.
Right.
Because dealers have, you know, very vastly different standards on their take on foreign cards. So, I mean, how do you kind of navigate that aspect of it?
Okay, so you're 100% right on that. I've talked to many shop owners, and they will typically not get into foreign stuff at all. Or if they do, it'll be at English price or less because they have a hard time moving it. As for me, I find eBay, man, it's worldwide. I've never had a problem. Certain cards, yes, they'll take a little bit longer to get rid of, especially in non-foil, but it's just like any other speculation. It depends on what you're diving into, right? If I have 40 Japanese Deathrite Shamans, I'm not going to have too hard of a time getting rid of them on eBay. Where if I've got like 40, I don't know, something really bad, Rock's Faith Menders in Japanese or something, right? Nobody's going to want them.
Right.
So you just got to know what you're getting into. Foils. I mean, if it's playable, you can sit on it forever, and the longer it takes to get rid of it, it's just going up, right?
I mean, that seems to be how it works.
So it all depends on what you can get into stuff at, right? You want to make sure that you're not getting into this stuff as high as possible, obviously. And that's one of the reasons why I go overseas. Places like Star City have Shonda Pyromaster foils in Japanese listed at $150. That's ridiculous, right? eBay, you can get rid of them at $75, $80s. But over there, they're trading them away at like 45s because that's their market. So it just, you know, you take a trip, you trade with some people, you see what the stores are selling stuff for there, and you just bring it back over here, and the arbitrage just instantly, you know, doubles it sometimes, even triples it sometimes.
So, right. Yeah. I mean, so let's, what's some of the, say somebody has, you know, and this is one I think I saw maybe a year ago now, like a foil Russian Emrakul. Set foil.
Right.
You know, that sort of stuff, you know, you talked about it being a couple times English multiplier. Well, how much is when you get to those, you know, those really playable legacy cards and you have a Russian foil or Korean foil, just give people an idea of how expensive those really get.
Okay. So we're talking, an English foil Emrakul here is what, like, man, I haven't looked at that card in forever. 150, 200, something like that for a pack foil?
Ish. Yeah.
Right. So when I seen that Russian one on eBay as well, and I want to say when it finally sold, it went for something like $2,200. And the big thing on these is definitely condition, right? If that thing just even had a teeny tiny nick on it or something, even if it was like that out of the pack, I mean, we're talking a swing of $500. I've been told in the past that especially with Russian sets and older Russian sets, the print run on foils ends up being that you might be able to make like 7 full sets in the world. Mm-hmm. So that's why something like that Emrakul is such a hard card to get.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously stuff like Japanese is printed more than Russian is. So it just really depends. And then again, it depends on the demand of the card. Jace the Mind Sculptor, Japanese foils were going for 2000. And then they got, well, they reprinted Jace in English in the From the Vaults. And even the Japanese ones are affected. Now they're like 16, which is still a huge amount. But all reprints affect this stuff left and right.
Well, you gotta worry about shill bidding to an extent too, because when you see like a Russian foil Dark Confidant sell for like $11,000 on eBay and no one else is selling them, you're like, well, I guess the price is $11,000, and then no one wants to pay that anywhere because that's ridiculous.
Right. And like, you wonder if that ever actually sold.
And everyone, the only price point they have is one eBay sale that may or may not have been legitimate. So right, it's, yeah, there's a lot of guesswork in this too.
Yeah, absolutely a name your own price kind of market, and you have to find the person who buys it, who wants it, you know.
Yeah, we talk a lot about trading with that guy.
Yeah, well, this is the market for that guy, right? Like,
right.
In no other market is finding that guy more important.
Well, let's say this. If you have a card that supposedly is going to sell for $2,000, you're not just, you know, going to have everybody coming to you. So it's a very small market for people that would pay that much for a single card in the first place. And I would assume that the people that do want that for a collection would be on like the high-end Magic on Facebook, or they'd be within a, you know, a click of people where they can say, I'm looking at this Russian Emrakul to complete my set. Is this too much, or what do you think the actual value is of it? And if it goes over that, they're just going to wait, because the people that spend $2,000 on a card are the most patient people I've ever seen.
Right. So yeah, I mean, for the takeaways for the 101 here, I mean, we're kind of looking at the order. You have, you know, your French, German, Italian, Chinese kind of, you know, at or below that English level, kind of right around there.
Technically, German is slightly higher. For some reason, it is. Okay. I don't know.
Yeah, sure.
Because German's amazing. As someone who built an entirely German EDA era legacy deck.
There it goes.
There are a lot of, you just go talk to people.
Smaller.
Like, I was able to do it because people had the cards because they collect them too. Like, German's a thing. No one's building an Italian legacy deck.
Very true. Very true.
Right. So you kind of got, you know, those are kind of your base level. And then you work your way up, you know, Japanese and then Russian, Korean. That's kind of the order.
Right.
The other takeaway that to take away from what we've been talking about is that you have to be patient with it and find the right person. And, you know, sometimes that person isn't always a dealer. If this is what you have, you need to get connected individually with a buyer.
Well, now on the flip side, mm-hmm. It's like, it depends on the price ranges you're in. I don't try to target the stuff that is $600, $700. I mean, I see lots of people over there with binders that are enough to buy five houses. But my thing is, I'll go in there with a bunch of dual lands and I will trade into cards that I know I can cash out $10, $15 all day. And obviously I'm getting into these things at like fives and sevens, 12s, whatever, because I can post 100 $10 cards on eBay and have them all gone in a week and a half. Where if I have a single card at $300, it could sit there for 6 months.
How is your portfolio balance, would you say, as far as what you keep on inventory?
So I try not to keep any inventory. If I'm moving stuff or basically, if I get into stuff and I haven't flipped it within a month's time, I'm doing something wrong with it. It's the way it goes. It's constantly moving.
How did you get into? So, I mean, you go to Japan, right? And you come back with cards. How did you – do you go strictly to flip Magic cards, or how did you get into this?
I've been going to Japan since 2002, and originally I just went there because I wanted to. It was fun. I liked video games. I used to do a lot of flipping of video games when the market was better, but now everything's gone digital, so I had to move on to something else.
Mm-hmm.
And nowadays, I just kind of plan my trips around when the GPs are. So I'll go to the GP for the whole weekend, and then I'll stay maybe 3 weeks, 4 weeks, and then I can have time to, you know, hang out with friends, do whatever I want to do, have the food, go have fun. But at the same time, I can go to the local shops and see what they've got in, like, you know, their foil boxes or their bulk boxes and stuff like that. So there's, you know, some extra stuff on the side. But the majority of everything I do is GPs.
You are a regular globetrotter, as it turns out.
Maybe. I mean, I still got to hit Europe. I've never been.
What is that flight time to Japan? Like 12 hours?
So I have to go to Dallas-Fort Worth first, and then it becomes 13-hour flight from Dallas.
Okay.
Right. It's
well.
So you don't speak much Japanese, so how do you get around for the whole month? I mean,
a lot of things in Japan, like a lot of signs will be Japanese and English, like in subways and stuff. There are some that aren't. I mean, you do pick up some phrases here and there. I really need to, like, just push myself to learn the language better. I've just been really lazy. And Japanese people, when they're in school, they are taught basic English in elementary school, and then it's up to them if they want to pursue it. So you can almost always find someone that speaks enough English to give you directions.
And
that being said, if you're stuck in like a tiny city, you're not going to find anybody.
Oh, I bet that could be leading to some interesting stories on your many trips.
Right, right.
No kidding. What is Japan like for an American, for those of us who have not been and have seen, you know, TV and nothing else?
Okay, so if you go into Tokyo to me, it's kind of like New York City. There's people from all over the world. You're going to run into foreigners left and right. It still has a bit of a Japanese feel, but I don't prefer it. I like Osaka better. Everything just seems more Japanese from like what you would see in books and TV and so on. Japanese people as a whole keep to themselves. It's just the way the society is. And, you know, since I'm from America, we're used to like going up to people, hey, how's it going? This, that, and so on, so on. And I've had a lot of Japanese people come up to me saying, it's amazing how you can make friends so easy. And it's like, I just go talk to people. But it's not so much they're shy. It's just they're taught not to get in anybody's business.
They
right?
really respect personal space.
Exactly.
Unless they're on the subway.
Oh, man.
So the things you see on TV where it's rush hour and they actually, like, they got an attendant and they're pushing people into the door, that actually happens. it really does. It's horrible.
So what about the food? I know the food's got to be amazing.
If you like seafood, you're set. You know, I hate seafood, so I have to find other food.
Oh, well, you could join Corbin. I think they got Buffalo Wild Wings out there for you guys.
Hey, what are you talking about, man? I'm all about some seafood, provided it's the right seafood.
Well, they've got everything over there, and it's fresh. As for me, I can still go to McDonald's. McDonald's got a teriyaki burger. Hell yeah. they've got other stuff. They've got, you know, KFC, this and that. They've got Japanese barbecue. They've got this meat thing they call – it's called yakiniku, right? And you sit down with your friends. You got this table, and in the middle of the table is this open flame. We'd never have it here because someone would burn themselves and they'd sue everybody, right? And you can pay for 90 minutes all you can eat and all you can drink. 90 minutes, man. And just
probably eat and drink quite a bit in 90 minutes.
Americans do. Japanese people are still just nibbling, right? I don't understand it, right? I guess it's because they can do it whenever they want. A lot of the bars there, actually, you can buy beer by the hour. And it's like $9.80 for an hour's worth of beer. Seriously.
And
yeah,
that's
right?
How the karaoke bars work, and that's the best way to do it, to get people nice and lubed up for some karaoke.
Right. But it's funny. So I'm sitting there with some friends, and there's like all these Japanese, and they're just kind of sipping their drinks, and they're talking, having chats like, you know, people do, right? And then all of a sudden we see, oh my God, we can buy by the hour. So we just like start ordering drinks left and right. We're watching the clock the whole time. Ladies come by, it's like, you got 10 minutes to go. We're like, we need 3 more beers. Just downing it, right? It's a race. It's kind of awesome. But yeah, an hour worth of drinks. We're talking the mid-range stuff, not the best stuff, but it's not the worst either. And it's like $9.80 for an hour.
Yeah, if you get 2 to 3 drinks an hour, you're doing better than the United States. By a long
shot. 2 to 3 an hour, dude. We're talking like 18, you know?
Ooh.
You got to race this. You got to get value.
There's
you don't get as much value after you get past a certain drink limit per hour. The value is negative. There's an inverse ratio to the value.
Eventually you will die. So yeah.
Eventually, right.
Eventually we will all die.
Yeah,
I think the contest is drink so much and see if you do or don't, right?
You either win or lose. It is 50-50.
Exactly. Take the chance.
So was
that definitely sounds like fun.
What was your beer? I know you had a count to highest record. What was it per hour?
Like I said, the best I've done was 18 in an hour.
No shit.
That being said, so it was 18. And then we were leaving. I missed my trains for some fucked up reason. The subways there close down at like midnight. And if you're stuck out, you either go to the karaoke bar or you're walking home. And we're talking this multi-million population city and the subways just stop. And they clean them and do all this other stuff. So it makes perfect sense, but it's just really weird to me. Anyway, so from where I was to get back to my hotel, I got a 45-minute walk. And on the way, I find some convenience stores. And in the convenience stores, you can buy beer 24/7. You can drink open container. Everything's fine. You can go drink in parks, whatever the hell you want, right? So I'm drunk off my ass, and I've walked past convenience stores. Like, boom, I'm getting two 500-milliliter beers, right? They're like $2.84 a piece. So Now the value's out the window, right? It's like, no more value, but I'm getting more beer, right? So I'm walking down the street, drinking this liter of beer. I get to the next one. I got to use the restroom really bad. I can't even open the door. Apparently it's a pocket door. It slides. And they're just laughing at me because I don't know how to work this fucking door. And I go up with two more beers. I hand them my empty cans. They're just looking at me. I'm like dropping my coins all over the counter. But they're still selling to me, right? So I take those and I keep walking, drinking another liter of beer. I find a McDonald's. It's 24 hours. Get a filet of fish, teriyaki burger, walk a little bit more. There's one more convenience store, one more liter of beer, barely get to my hotel, just pass out. It was awesome. But I am alive.
That is an interesting way to spend a night in Japan. I'll give you that.
It is. It is. It's kind of fun.
I honestly think, yeah, you would drink me under the table. I don't think I could keep up with that one.
It's, I don't know, man. You just get over there. You start getting used to it, right?
That's what it's hear. I do hear they do a lot of drinking in Japan. You just fall into the groove.
It's a way to do it, man. And they offer some different things too. You can get like mixed drinks when, like a lot of the bars when you're doing mixed drinks will have a flat rate. Like one bar will be every drink you want's $4. It doesn't matter. You want a Long Island iced tea? $4. You want a martini? $4. Who cares? But they also have weird flavors like black currant, stuff like that. They mix alcohol with tea, whatever.
So when you're out there, do you ever buy boxes or is that just bad value? You just go trading for cards or?
So actually I've done this a couple times. Boxes over there are about $100 a piece. That's tax included. It just really depends on the set. You know, some stuff's going to be better than others. I don't know. You can trade away sealed packs. I've done that before. If you have Japanese sealed packs, just go to a GP and you're like, you know, trade them away. It's $6 a piece. If you buy a box at $100, you end up trading the whole box out for like 180. So it's pretty good.
So how is it true that, you know, this is kind of the thing going around that people over there, they don't value their Japanese foils worth as much, but they do want English foils. Is that true or not true?
So I find most people don't want foils at all. And I think a reason for this is Japanese has a very humid climate. And, you know, they like to curve when they get in that humidity.
Mm-hmm.
So more people I find want the non-foils, but they're willing to get rid of their Japanese foils. Some people watch the world market and will right. want more. And those you walk away from. Other people go by the Japanese market. For some reason, they don't use eBay very often. They use Yahoo Auctions. Which, like, I don't even know if it exists here anymore.
I never heard of that in my life.
Totally weird, right?
Yeah, but you go everywhere. Like, people in Canada were talking about some weird site. Do you remember what that site Ryan Abusid was talking about, Bouchard?
Yeah.
Some Canadian auction site. Like,
yeah, but it was, like, attached to eBay. It was weird.
Yeah.
Hmm.
But it was still like, yeah, I'm not surprised that Japan uses something wacky.
Well, it's not that it's something, it's that it's Yahoo, right? Like, it's like wacky. Not wacky. It's just weird.
Right.
It's not even like some Japanese site.
I remember Yahoo Auctions being here, but I thought they like closed down the U.S. branch in like 2001 or something like that because nobody used it, right?
I never knew it existed. So
that's... Okay. So that being said, you know, it's just a whole different market because it's pretty much self-contained. So people will trade away their Japanese foils. There's this, that fine line between whether you're scumming somebody or you're getting a good deal, right? Because I don't want to be the guy that sits there and says, oh, your card's only worth this amount, right? But at the same time, if some guy comes up to me and says, I only want this amount, it's like, I don't want to say no, right?
You're not a scumbag for not arguing with somebody.
Well, I especially think once you've taken the effort to fly to Japan and somebody wants to sell you their cards at Japanese prices, I mean, I feel like you've earned it at that point.
Fair enough. Fair enough. It does cost a pretty good amount to get over there. But that being said, so like I'm sitting there at the table and this guy is like frantically running around to a bunch of people. He's got a foil Japanese Cavern of Souls and he needs to unload it. He wants a non-foil and everybody's like, I don't have him. He comes up to me. Do you have a non-foil? I'm like, sure, I got a non-foil. So I'm like, you know, I'll take this, start digging. So he grabs out a non-foil English one. And he's like, can I get more? I'm like, sure. You know, I mean, I didn't say how much it's worth, but I'm thinking this cavern's worth like $100, right? And he ends up grabbing like two more cards, like Amizia Mortars and something else that's like $7. And he's like, I'm good with this. And it ends up being like an extra $70 in my favor. And yes, I feel kind of bad about it, but at the same time, it's like, That's what he wanted. I don't know.
You can't be upset if both people walk away happy.
It's true.
It's scummy if you had proposed that and you knew you had him over a barrel. But like, right. If he's happy with that, like, or who like, are you to argue? And plus, you said take more, so.
Like, yeah, like, or, like, yeah. I mean, was it $70 in your favor, like, on the Japanese market, or, like, because you know what the card fetches here?
Because I know what it fetches.
Like, exactly. Like, that doesn't matter to him, right?
Yeah, that's
right.
He's not going to get that price. He's not going to
fly back to
the United
States. Yeah, that literally means nothing to him. Yeah,
yeah, that $70 comes out of your plane ticket. Yeah.
Somebody can come offer me, like, $10 more on an English Cavern of Souls or whatever, right? And they may be able to take it back home to, you know, wherever, Singapore, and sell it for all kinds of money. But that, you know, more power to them. It doesn't matter to me. So, like, right. I don't feel like anybody's going to come back in that situation.
But there's going
to
be somebody out there that are going to call us sharks and scumbags for supporting Dustin's behavior. So,
all right, let's move on into an email here.
Well, can I throw in one more?
Yeah,
point
yeah, absolutely.
Here?
Go ahead.
Okay, so. I've heard this from multiple people. I've heard this from a couple people in Europe, and I've also heard it from some Japanese people, that one of the reasons Russian cards are so rare outside of Russia is Russian customs will stop you, and if you have a lot of Russian product, they will not let you take it out of the country.
That sounds something Russian to do.
Right. So a lot of, like, stores will not ship it out of the country, and I guess if you were to go to the GP over there and you get stuck at the airport and they search your bag, and you're not a Russian citizen, and all your cards are Russian, they're probably going to confiscate them.
Huh. And you might go to Russian jail.
Yeah. What I really want to know is, can you trade cards for blue jeans?
Probably. You know, I've actually traded cards for Japanese video games before, so anything goes, man.
Yeah, I actually had, like, a Russian importer that I was trying to get some Russian boxes from or cases that he could get over legitimately. But the prices they were charging him over there wholesale were just not even worth it. You know, they're like 120, 130 for in Russia without whatever he was going to charge on top of it. So
yeah. And at that point, yeah, you're not making anything.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Nice. Soviet Russia prices gouge you.
So, keeping with the international theme today, we have an email from, Boris in the Netherlands.
Boom. Segue.
Yeah, that's right. All right. He's got a couple questions here. He goes, he says, hello, you clowns. As to quote a former listener email, love the podcast, longtime listener. Finance 101 seems like a great addition. I've got a few questions which might be addressed here, but maybe the questions are more like Finance 201. That's fine. Well, okay, first question. What is the impact on the value of Magic cards now that fetches are reprinted? Wizards just inflated the market by announcing Onslaught fetches, and that most Magic card owners now experience a drop in their collection value. My $1,000 deck is suddenly worth $400. What does this mean to the average card player and trader? Do the other cards rise in value because of the inflation, or do all Magic cards drop in value because the collections are worth less? So this is actually a really good question. If you think about, you know, your Legacy deck, that, you know, say it's $1,000 and a lot of it's the fetch lands, will the market correct so that the other cards rise in value to kind of maintain that price point? Or will, you know, or did the whole market, the whole Legacy card pool market just kind of lose value as a whole because of this? What do you guys think?
There's nothing enforcing the price of Legacy as a whole. Like, when we say, oh, you know, if cards go down a set, something will pick up the slack, that's because the price of a total set is enforced by Modo Redemption. There's nothing enforcing the price of Legacy, which is why the prices were allowed to just scale out of control, because there's no set price. It's just the total cost of Legacy is the sum total of all the cards. And their associated scarcities and their associated amount of time since they were printed and all that sort of thing. If more people play Legacy, then all the cards are going to cost more. So since there's nothing enforcing it, there's nothing really that's going to control, and the cards are not tied to the price of anything else.
So, I mean, do you guys think that there's this argument that more people will get into Legacy now because of fetch lands, and that will raise the other prices? Or do you think that, you know, dual lands are still kind of the logjam there?
Dual lands.
Yeah, I think having a $15 fetch to get a $250 underground C is not really much different than having a $35 fetch to get a $250 underground
right.
C.
Right.
Like, fetch lands aren't going to make Legacy playable. It's going to be, you know, and honestly, like, the decks that are affordable in Legacy don't run the fetches anyway. Like, if you want to play Legacy for cheap, you can. It just won't be super competitive. But you're going to have to play it for a while and learn the format. And then if you want to start buying that stuff, the amount you're going to have to shell out, the price difference between an expensive fetch and a cheap fetch is, it's not trivial, but it's not the most important factor.
Right.
Okay.
I think that also it's helping modern, obviously, but the fetches came down a little bit. They're going to drop a little bit more while they keep getting open in standard. They will go back up some. So if somebody wants to play Legacy, it's a good time to get pieces, right? Because certain cards will eventually go up to kind of cushion the fall that the fetches had.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's fair. We've definitely seen all the old versions of the fetches take huge dives, obviously, and now people can get the new ones to get in. All right, so let's move on to the second question, which is kind of one of those – I like this because it's one of those questions that's always there but never really answerable. So he says, the price is always dependent on supply and demand. Why is there no Uber geek who found a formula for the correct future price of a card with parameters like – number of cards printed, number needed in decks, number the deck is played in, years ago it was released, the format, etc. He says, when I hear you guys talk about card price, it's always one of these parameters, but they're all connected. Could you call out for some extremely mathematical economics magic guy to solve this? So, I'll jump in here. Yeah, I like these questions. It's, for as much, yeah, exactly. Like, it is a irrational market in large part. A lot of things make sense in the Magic market, and that's how we're able to kind of stay ahead of the trend. Sometimes cards just spike because you kind of hit that breaking point. You look at something like Splinter Twin a while back. Nothing changed from the day that card was like $10 or $8 or whatever it was to the day it was like $20, except that you kind of hit that magic point where few enough were there that somebody noticed and bought some more. Dealers all started raising their price and the hype feeds on itself, and all of a sudden the cards doubled, tripled in price. You can't really predict that when the market is as irrational as it is. You know, we can certainly look ahead at stuff and say, like, you know, when the Zendikar fetch lands are eroding down to standard, these will eventually be more expensive, blah, blah, blah. But it's really hard to say, you know, this card will be exactly this card or this price at this time. What we do is we look at older cards that are similar to try to gauge future value. And that is a very, very good and usually correct way to price out cards. But sometimes you just don't know when it's going to hit that magic point and people are going to catch on and it's going to hit the hive mind and it's going to jump. That's why a lot of times, you know, Magic finance, especially when it comes to predicting card prices, is as much of an art as it is a science.
I think the problem is his question's also asking for a formula, and we don't know exactly how many players are playing each format. Sure, you can find out what the print run was, but we don't know how many copies of a cards get lost in natural disasters. You know, a flood happens and someone loses collections, right? There's just no way to have a exact number for tracking how many exist and where the trend should go.
And there are too many variables. The metagame isn't defined enough for us to control for any one variable enough to plug everything else in.
Right.
I think it's the only way you could possibly come up with something like this is when you get something like Moto, because it operates a lot more efficiently, right, Marcel?
Exactly. It moves at an insane pace.
What do you mean by efficiently?
I mean, it's a lot easier. Sure, you're right.
Throw out some more Finance 101 tips.
You're right. Well, what that means is that it's a lot easier for people to, you know, a lot more simple for people to acquire cards and to sell those cards. So the market moves. When you say it moves efficient, it means that there's this constant transaction between buying and selling and it moving. Whereas when it's in paper, sometimes it doesn't work like that because people just keep a card or they decide, hey, I'm going to put this on the kitchen table. So it's not like it's always sitting on the market because it's just a lot more difficult to do so in paper than it is online.
And if I order a card on Moto, I have it instantly versus it takes a week to get there in the mail and the price shifts a lot and then it takes me another week to get it listed and for somebody to buy it and have it in their hands. Like, with the instant transaction speed on Moto, you're taking weeks out of, you know, the equation there.
Right.
So that's, you know, when Corbin says efficiency, that's what he means by that.
Yeah. All right. So we've got one more here. He says, you guys always say the prices of staples will go up, but won't prices eventually drop on all Magic cards because of the enormous card pool WotC's creating? Power creep on creatures, spells, and lands will always bring better cards into the Magic gene pool. but my best deck will always be 75 cards. The 75 best, of course, but when WotC prints 1,000 best cards, then the price on them will be less than if there were only 300 best cards. Hope to hear your opinion on the podcast or the site. He says, final remark, make longer podcasts are just too good. And P.S., if you like beer, you have to go to Belgium or the Netherlands. if there's a GP or Pro Tour in Brussels, Antwerp, or Amsterdam, go there. I would love to do that one day.
Or we could import their beer.
but yeah, I mean, so his question is, you know, something can only be the best until something else comes along. So, you know, the average price of a Magic card will be lower when there's, you know, 50,000 in existence than if there are 10,000.
Sure. If personal taste didn't mean anything.
Right.
Wouldn't Magic suck if there were one best deck and that was the only deck everybody played?
Well, I mean, I think the big factor that this person's missing too is like, there's not being more of those old cards printed, but there's more players coming in. So, like, as long as the amount of players coming into Magic is exceeding the amount of, like, access that they're printing, which, you know, they have algorithms and a marketing department devoted to that, like, you have to be fine, right? Like, I mean, if Yu-Gi-Oh! Gets away with what they do in the market, then there's no way Magic has any concerns yet.
Well, and there's power creep, but there's also them being like, we don't want to print anything this powerful again.
Well, and there's also, I mean, but on a sense, he's right. There are cards that a couple years ago were very good in Legacy, and then they basically just got replaced by something else and are no longer played or not worth a lot of money. But it actually kind of goes back to the market inefficiency we were just talking about. The prices on those cards don't necessarily tank because people don't rush to put them up there because it's just not always worth it to a lot of players, or, you know, say, hey, this was played once, maybe I'll need it again. Sort of thing. So the price kind of moves slowly down. So in a sense, it is true. On the other hand, if you actually consider the amount of cards for these formats that we're talking about that come out in every set, every year, the number's fairly low, you know, because if you have a 300 card set, like a couple dozen are going to be relevant at most long term. So the rate, even though, you know, they print thousands of cards a year, the rate at which they're actually diluting that share of the market, the expensive-ish competitive share of it, is not all that fast. So in a sense, you're right. It does happen, but it is weighed out, you know, by the other factors of more people coming in and there being different decks and people wanting to play what they've always played and that sort of thing.
Also, if they make new, better cards, they could always work with cards that weren't played very much. And next thing you know, a dollar card's $15, $20. So yes, some are dropping, but others are going up.
Yeah. Like Dark Depths and Deathless Age and
X-Mage, right. Yeah.
All of a sudden, blam, you get this expensive card that everybody wants.
Right. So as long as you have a diverse collection, are you losing money or is the money just moving around?
Yeah, it moves around from here and there. Like I've done that. I held on to a lot of my cards that just rotate that you would have to sell at bulk. And then all of a sudden you get like a $4 uncommon, $5 rare just out of nowhere. And just, yeah, it's good to hold on
well,
to.
I mean,
no rush to sell bulk. That's the best part about a bulk rare. It only goes up.
Unless you are moving, you do not want to take that shit with you.
I mean, I will throw out the caveat, like there, you know, that Ryan mentioned that there's more people coming into the game. You know, we're having a different conversation if Magic is contracting every year rather than growing. Especially, you know, if 5 years from now the game is smaller than it is, and Theros and Return to Ravnica are those high points. You know, those cards won't be getting more expensive. They will, for the most part, be stagnating or dropping. You know, that's why it is so important to follow the overall trajectory that Magic's on, because it's just something you have to keep in mind. And there's no reason to think that Magic won't, you know, continue growing a little, or even just, you know, even stagnation in terms of the player base is fine if the number of people coming in equals the number of people leaving. You know, so, but Magic's been through a lot. It's been through a period of prolonged contraction, and we're currently still in a period of, you know, prolonged growth. So it's right. Just, you know, rising tide lifts all boats, and that I think covers up a lot of things when it comes to speculation these days. But, you know, that's the reality in which we live right now. And until we see something that's going to change that, you just have to operate with the factors that you're given.
I also think now with Hasbro and Magic making as much money as they do for Hasbro, they can see those trends. And as soon as one starts to happen, they have more money to throw behind it to fix it. So they can stop the contraction.
Then why isn't Moto better?
Oh, man. Because it's shit on a stick.
It's a good question.
Well, it is a good question. We all have hope for it, right? I mean, we've obviously talked about this ad nauseum, but Moto right now costs for them very little to run and makes them a lot of money. So, like, it's kind of like on Hasbro's end, if you just look at it from a dollar's perspective, as somebody who knows nothing about Magic.
Let's not go down this rabbit hole. Let's stop it now. Let's stop.
All right. That's what I'm saying, man. If it's not broke, don't fix it to the executive.
No, that's a horrible excuse, and I'm not going to engage this because I'm just going to get frustrated.
I think their excuse is if they put money into it, then their profit margins are smaller.
That's exactly what I'm saying.
Yeah, and I think that's the wrong decision because they can
if
make
they
more
don't
money.
Pay well below market for programmers.
It's
right.
Certainly,
have
yeah,
to pay
it's
more for
certainly
programmers.
It's certainly the wrong decision for us. It doesn't mean it's the wrong decision for their shareholders.
Yeah.
So, all right. So let's just move on. Let's talk some spoilers.
Yes, the good stuff. Let's talk about my favorite card of the set. I don't care about any of these other cards.
Myself's favorite card of the set.
Which one do you think it is? Take a guess.
Clever impersonator.
Yeah, you got it. That's yeah. It. First hit.
Pretty good.
I saw that. I was like, this is going right into the cube.
Oh, the cube.
The cube that doesn't quite exist yet, right?
Hey, it's coming. Half of it's.
That's what I'm saying. So you had to cut something before you even had it in your hands.
I already have something cut.
His cube is just
as
intangible as Khanda Tarkir cards. He doesn't have those in his hands either.
But I can see them on my screen, and I play Moto, so it's good enough to me.
So, I mean, let's talk about the most recent spoilers. I mean, what stands out to you guys?
Well, obviously the clever impersonator. You should definitely pick up your foil copies because that's going to be played in, what, EDH and cubes?
It's going to be played in everything, even in standard.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
It's just crazy.
It's pretty nuts.
It's a very good card.
It was pre-selling at 8 or 7 or 8, and now it's like 15 now for the regular.
I mean, it certainly will not stay that. It's not mythic, is it?
It's mythic.
Right.
I don't think I think the regular copies will come down, but foils
set,
are just going to
shoot. The set's going to sell so much, and I think this is probably an $8 to $10 card. I could be super duper wrong, and everyone's like, "How did you not see this was going to be 20?" I don't see it as a 4 of, you know. I don't see it in a ton of decks in standard. It's not splashable like Phyrexian Metamorph. It's not super efficient like Phantasmal Image. I just don't see it being a million of, and like. I mean, I think 12 to 15 seems okay for this card, and if it goes above that, like, what are people doing with the rest of the set?
Khanda of Tarkir is going to be the best-selling Magic set of all time. There's going to be a lot of them on the market, and this set is already jam-packed with value. Like, by the time Redemption is over, like we said before, like, that money has to go somewhere, and you can't have a bunch of $15, $20 fetch lands and a bunch of, you know, other $15 mythics.
Right.
Yeah. So I think anywhere between 10 and 15 seems all right for this guy. Like I don't think he should be above that. It would be if we'd seen a lot of mythics that were much better, like if the Planeswalkers were a little better and there's some better mythics spoiled so far, I could say a little bit more authoritatively that, you know, it'll probably be below that, but they're spoiling a lot of EDH mythics that'll take a few years to really catch on. But man, I'm really liking this set.
So I agree with you on the price on Impersonator. I think though that closer towards its rotation when rotation time and it's staying in, I think that'll be more like $5 or $6 because there'll be so many floating.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I could see that. But can I talk about my favorite myth? Have I talked about the See the Unwritten on this cast yet?
Yes.
I don't care. I'm going to talk about See the Unwritten again. This is very good in Maelstrom Wanderer. Okay. I just needed to get that.
All right.
See the Unwritten? Right. Oh, yeah. That we were oozing over that card.
I've got one, and this is – I got one to talk about, and this will, I think, make Ryan and Marcel happy. Kheru? K-H-E-R-U? Kheru, I assume that's how you say that? Kheru Lich Lord? The green, black, blue?
Oh, the new one?
Rare?
Yeah.
Sultai Obsidian.
It's got your word on it, man.
Graveyard, baby.
Does it say graveyard theme?
It does say graveyard. It's 3 mana to bring anything from your graveyard to your upkeep to the battlefield. It gets flying, trample, haste, exile it at your end step.
Right. Now the catch is it is random.
It is random. However,
no interest.
You're only putting ash. If you're only putting Ashen Riders in your graveyard, man,
stop it.
Yeah.
Stop it.
Ryan's gonna do it. Fuck.
No, I have no interest in this card. Like, I saw this card and I was like, this is a really bad seance.
Oh my god.
Yeah, it's horrible.
Yeah, it attacks and blocks.
This card is ball bags.
Well, what about you, Ryan? What are you looking at? What's caught your eyes from the recent?
There's a card.
If I had to guess, I would say that Ryan really likes Wingmate Rock.
Does he like the new Thassa?
Wait, is Wingmate Rock the 3-mana 3/3 flying Vigilance Haste guy?
No, 3/4.
That's Mantis Rider, and Mantis Rider is a lot of fun.
Mantis Rider is sweet. Okay, so like, I really either want to be playing American Midrange, which like Mantis Rider is.
Oh, fuck yourself.
A love child for that. Yeah, it's that's right. I can't do that one. No one knows what I'm talking about. It's killing me. Until everyone else starts using them, I can't do it. Like, I try it all week and people just like, I lose them mid-conversation when I start referencing
You can call it American, but you have to spit tobacco spit out of your mouth every time you say American.
American.
I mean, I really like the Siege Rhino and the Demon guy. Like, I think that Siege Rhino is sweet. I mean, it's not Thragtusk, but...
First white demon ever. Butcher of the Horde. Quite good. Yeah.
But my favorite card in the set, which, I mean, if anyone actually knew me would know this would be my favorite card in the set, is also a mythic, and is called, it is that Sea of the Unwritten. Yeah, that's right. You already talked about it. But this isn't free EDH. This card is actually going to be constructible.
Yes, it is.
We talked about this last week. Of course it is.
We did not talk about last week was another EDH all-star, Hooded Hydra. So I said on Twitter this week,
that wasn't even out
like
last
week. A year and a half ago, Corbin and I were like, man, Hydras are good. You look at something like Apocalypse Hydra that went up like 300% since it was standard legal. Colony Hydra went up to like $9. Hydras are really good.
Bordeaux Hydra. Yep.
Yeah, and then Wizards are like, guess what? We're going to print 2 Mythic Hydras and 5 Rare Hydras in every block. So suck a bag of fucks. I wish they would stop putting out so many Hydras, but Hooded Hydra is so good, it invalidates the last 25 Hydras. Hooded Hydra it's in the same vein as Chasm Skulker. So one of the things we like about Chasm Skulker is people hesitate to kill it. So Hooded Hydra has two ways to play it. You can play it as a guaranteed 5 counter Hydra and then make that 10, then 20 with Pharrell, or you could play it as an X Hydra because you put a billion counters on Astro Cornucopia with Pharrell. So either way, Hooded Hydra is very good in decks that run stuff like Dublin Season. Decks that double counters like Varel, obviously, but anything that gives you a bunch of mana. Like, Hooded Hydra is nutty because even if they wrath the board, you've got a million snakes.
That makes me think it may be constructed playable, just to the extent that it's protection against a board wipe.
Mm. I mean, that's like, if people were talking about Chasm Skulker, green is already going to be a thing. Like, green is the only deck people are talking about Nykthos being run in standard. Miscutter's so good because it's pro blue, but I could really see, like, if they're going to be wrathing and utter ending and stuff like that, utter end will keep it from triggering that clause, but the other stuff they're killing it with, I don't know. It's definitely an EDH card. And I could see it impacting standard.
What about you, Dustin? What are you looking at? It's catching your eye.
Man, so this is like so simplistic, but it's got to get played. Utter end.
Of course. Yeah, we were all very much in favor of that card.
Yeah, I mean, it just makes a lot of sense. If you stop comparing it to Vindicate and start comparing it to Hero's Downfall, I think people will like it a lot more than they do.
I think I like comparing it to Oblivion Ring that cannot be removed and at an instant speed.
Right.
Doesn't kill Stormbreath.
The other thing I was looking at that's interesting, I don't know if this will see play, Mindswipe. I mean, it's like Syncopate, but it hurts, right?
Man, if they print it Delver again.
It's one of those cards that won't have a deck. Everyone's like, Steam Augury is so good, but it doesn't. Right. I don't know. I think what I said on QS about Mindswipe is, at first it looks about half as good as Sphinx's Revelation, but if you really read into it, it's actually about a third as good.
Right.
But I mean, this is a different thing though. Like, if you're playing a control deck and then you're able to turn your counter spell into a damage spell, that's like insanely powerful.
But that doesn't matter, right? In a control deck, because that's not how control decks win. It matters in the tempo deck. That's why I said Delver. Like, that's the deck where it would matter.
If this is like a 4 mana counter spell, unless they pay 2, take 2, like in a tempo deck, I could see that.
That's the only shell in which it is good.
Relevant is the fact that they still take the damage if they pay the mana and their spell resolves.
Yeah. Like I said, if burn is a thing, like, or, you know, these sort of, like, if there's some sort of red deck that can also play blue, then this does provide a little reach to sink your mana in the late game while at the same time possibly protecting a creature on turn 3 or 4, you know? Like, that's the only deck where it could really get run. Like, control decks are very unlikely to run it.
Hey, Ryan, is this going to get run in American?
probably not.
Will these colors run?
Like, I really want the card to be good. Yes, good. Good talk. Now, I really want this card to be run, but, like, the extra... Like, there's such a big difference between Syncopate and this card, and this card is probably much worse than Syncopate because of that red mana sitting there.
Yeah. I'm a big fan, and this is a card I don't know if it will get played in Standard because stats like this just aren't as impressive as they should be. Siege Rhino.
Siege Rhino.
It's an Abzan rare. 4/5 trample. Whenever it enters the battlefield, each opponent loses 3 life. You gain 3 life. Like, the stats and the abilities on that are very impressive. But we saw a lot of 4-mana 5/5s not get played in the last 2 years, so I don't know.
But you know what? This reminds me of Loxodon and Hierarch.
Mm-hmm.
Where, like, you had Stone Cloaker and all kind of shenanigans with Loxodon and Hierarch, but, like, this isn't the color of bringing stuff back from the dead and, you know, getting those triggers again. You're not going to be flashing this guy out and getting the triggers that way, but if you can bring him back, or you can just, like, pitch him in the yard and reanimate him, like, I don't know, man. Siege Rhino.
See, here's a question, though. Like,
6-point life swing on a relevant body.
That was the card I was talking about. Like, that one and the demon, I think, are both really good. Yeah. Like, I don't even think you need shenanigans with the Rhino. Like, I want to look at this card and be like, oh, it's not Thragtusk, like I said, but, like, Thragtusk was phenomenal. Like, this card doesn't have to be Thragtusk to get played. Like, this card seems absolutely fine without any shenanigans.
So you look at the other 4-mana options. You know, you have, like, Pelucranos, Xenagos. I mean, I don't think that this card is better than Pelucranos. Is it better than Xenagos? I don't know. It can trample over that token and kill the Xenagos while providing the life swing. Is this something that doesn't get played until Pelucranos rotates?
It's in a totally different mid-range type build.
But, like, all those decks are basically already going to be on, like, a Sylvan Caryatid hit cast it on turn 3 plan. So, like, especially given the mana, the way, like, I don't know if playing 3 colors for something that loses in battle to Pelucranos is better than just playing Pelucranos if you're already playing
green. It's Abzan, though. Like, Abzan has a million ways to make this a 5/6 by the time it attacks.
Well.
There you go.
That's fair.
Okay, I want to talk about Thassa, the new Thassa in the set, Sultai Ascendancy. I think this card, it looks very underwhelming on the surface, but I think this card is going to probably be one of the better Ascendancies.
So what's it do?
At the beginning of your upkeep, look at the top 2 cards of your library, put any amount of them into your graveyard, and rest on top of your library in any order. So this is basically like Scry 2 with upside for the Sultai clan.
Look at the top 2 of your library, put any number of them into the graveyard. Okay. I don't know.
Thassa, I mean, you were perfectly happy with Thassa not being anything but in
Thassa,
the champion.
Thassa also turns your guys unblockable, and it was a creature a lot of the time.
But you were not happy with it not being a creature. Sure, it makes your creatures unblockable, but this gives you Scry too.
I understand that. I understand this, like, Thassa had a lot of upside that this card doesn't. It will always be exactly what it is. Like, the draw to Thassa is that in her worst case scenario, where she's just an enchantment that scries, it's something you're okay with. In the best case scenario, she's insane and wins the game. This doesn't really have, like, a best and worst case scenario. It will always just
be
exactly what it is.
This best case scenario is it's a harder to cast Thassa.
Yeah, like, well.
I'm sorry you guys don't see it. I see
the power of them, but it's hard to justify a spot in the deck for.
Yeah. I mean, I'm clearly not allowed to use the term graveyard theme, so.
No, do what you want, man.
Like, I'm sorry, the writing's on the wall. Like, this card, like, I don't know how no one else sees, like, there's going to be a graveyard based deck, and, like, this potentially could be better than Thassa in that deck. Like, in a vacuum, this card is worse than Thassa. In the format, I think it could be better.
Yeah,
like, you're probably not turning Thassa on anymore. And this card, like, there's going to be situations where you want the top card, and, like, Thassa would do nothing, essentially. Like, that Scry wasn't relevant at that point, but this lets you still pitch the card below it or something like that. Like, it lets you dig deeper through turns into the future as well. Like, it actually is going to draw you more cards than Thassa would.
I want to see some good delve spells. cycles.
Yeah, but every card you pitch, you're adding to your graveyard. Yeah. You're delving in. And also, what about the general? Every time you put a creature into your graveyard,
that card is not standard playable.
That card is standard playable. That card is the best general.
That card is insane.
Yes.
Doesn't it cost six mana?
Oh, my God. No, it costs four mana. It's a 3/3 and it makes two.
I'm with you. I'm with you.
Comes with five power when you, I think you guys are just so anti-graveyard.
I
just don't like you using the fact that there's delve to justify the stupid shit you said about Jace.
It has nothing to do with
delve. That's 100% of what I'm
saying. Hey, hold up. Fogo Pit. You're gonna eat it.
Oh, my gosh. Okay. Here's my take on it, right? And I'm the guy who really would like to brew up the reanimator deck, okay? I'm just saying that three mana cards that do not affect the board in any way the turn in which they are cast, when they cost three different colors of mana, traditionally have not been insane. I think if you're in this deck that wants to play with your graveyard, you're probably just playing Satyr Wayfinders and crap like that to fill up your graveyard. Maybe this is like a one of in these decks because it's one of those that's kind of cool, but like you draw two of them and all of a sudden you have a bunch of do-nothing cards and you just die. Like, I'm just saying, cards like this in the past have traditionally not been very good.
I feel like we're debating the raw power of Legion's Initiative all over again. That's what I think of when we see this. It may be better for enabling the stuff that it enables than Legion's Initiative was. I just don't know if people will justify giving this a spot in the deck. I'm not denying that this is a very good card, and for the delve and stuff you're trying to set up, the advantage engine it sets up is very relevant. I just don't know if it will get a spot in the deck.
I wish this card was standard playable with Deathrite Shaman. I mean, that would have been amazing. You know
what is standard playable? Deflecting Palm!
Yeah.
This is one of the first of this effect that has a fixed mana cost, and it's a very cheap fixed mana cost. I can see Deflecting Palm doing nothing, and I can see it ending games. I have no idea what to call this card financially.
The card is red-white. The next time a source of your choice would deal damage to you this turn, prevent it. If damage is prevented this way, Deflecting Palm deals that much damage to that source's controller. Others in the past have redirected it to creatures, so it was kind of like a removal spell.
Yeah, this doesn't affect the board at all. Like, I mean, yeah, it prevents, it's like life gain and transfers it as. This is like a life prevention spell.
As someone who played a burn deck that used the Shining Shoal to kill people, like I was using the two damage from Char hitting me to Shining Shoal them. Like traditionally, stuff like this in the past hasn't had a fixed mana cost, and people have really tried to play with those spells. The fact that it's got a fixed mana cost means this could be experimentable. If it had an X in it, like redirect X damage, I don't think it would be as good. So I'm interested to see if this card does something, and if the fact that it can't hit creatures holds it back, as opposed to the fact that you had to pay mana for it.
Didn't Shining Shoal prevented damage to creatures, and not just yourself?
Shining Shoal was, it was a source to a target of your choice, I think.
So the last card of these in this vein that saw any constructed play was Refraction Trap. Which was that if a red instant or sorcery was cast, you could pay white and it would block and redirect three. That card was played against mono, like it was sideboard against mono red decks at the time. You know, that said, it hit creatures, so you could use it to kill their creatures. So I'm saying there is a precedent for these being played recently.
Way also saw fringe play, but that also was to creatures, I think.
Right? That was mostly savior dudes.
Yeah, I really think that this card won't make it because it doesn't hit creatures.
I mean, that's...
That said, that's, nobody that's, can nobody can fireball you out of a commander game with this.
Well, it's going to be bulk, so I would like it to have upset.
Yeah.
Okay. Oh, God, there was a card.
What do you guys think about the charms, now that we got more of these charms out here? Which ones are speaking to you guys as far as...
The Jeskai one is sweet.
Jeskai for sure.
Dumb in a format with fetch lands. Response to your fetch land, when I put your dude on top of your library. All right, proceed. Go ahead and shuffle up.
Ryan used Jeskai instead of American. Good work.
Charm!
Like I said, I've been like transitioning. I've been talking to people all week and I've had like to go to start using American again because nobody knows what the hell I'm talking about.
This is the one that you can put a creature on top of its own library, like you said, in response to fetches, which is great. It can do 4 damage to an opponent, Boros Charm style. And you can give your creatures +1/+1 lifelink. I mean, the modes are really powerful. You kind of need that 3-4 color control deck, I think, for this to get played. And even then, I don't know, like, it's very good, but we don't know exactly how those three colors will work. Like, how easy it will be to get that, or if somebody playing those color combinations needs this effect.
Right.
I think you want all of these effects. Like, if the Jeskai is looking to be this, like, mid-range, kind of like Time Spiral era Lightning Angel deck that was around, which is what I'm seeing with, like, the 3-3 flyer and stuff.
Mantis,
like,
Rider!
All of these things are extremely relevant.
You're right. In that case, if it just comes down to being like a control deck, kind of like the red, white, blue decks of the past 12 months, I don't think it's control though.
Like, I mean, look at Prowess. Like, Prowess is not a control mechanic. Prowess is this like mid-range, land a couple of guys, and you do have control elements, but you're much more playing like a fairy style deck or something like that. Where like counter spells, potentially some burn. Like, I mean, think of it like red, blue Delver, you know, like that's what this is.
And it seems to me that Mardu is like swarm aggro. Teamers like your mid-range aggro control, play a 4-4 and protect it. Jeskai is sort of like your fairy style deck. Sultai is like your graveyard based control deck, and Abzan is sort of like your turtle control deck almost, like,
yeah,
gain some life, prevent some damage, and just kind of turtle and wear them down. Jeskai is probably going to want to stick something like, you know, your Jeskai Rider or your Manus Rider or your Dragon Style Twin or, you know, some sort of goofy looking flying crane type thing that looks like it's from the Jackie Chan cartoon.
What about you, Dustin? What charms are speaking to you?
I'm liking Temur Charm. It seems powerful for what it is, and I think Temur as a whole, with Sylvan Caryatid and stuff, is easier to make the mana. You know, you're going to be able to get that third mana if you don't already have it out in land.
I think Savage Knuckleblade is going to really impact Standard because it does everything you want a creature in that aggro control type deck to do. It protects itself. It's got a real aggressive casting cost to power and toughness ratio. It's got three relevant abilities. I didn't think the haste was super relevant until I realized that if you bounce him, you'll want to replay him. And giving him haste when you replay him, savage. He's savage. You know, swinging for six the turn after you replay him. I think having something like that, a Savage Knuckleblade that you can sit behind and just ride to victory, that Temur Charm does a lot of things to protect him and clear the way.
And Adamant Negation, I think, is actually going to be a pretty good card in the format. That's the one that counter-targets spell. Unless the controller pays one, but if it's ferocious, then you just counter-target spell. And that's just for one blue. And so you're going to have there's a number of cards that you're going to get that ferocious out. So, you know, this is definitely one of the cards that's going to activate that, and this is going to scare people. You got that one blue open, you can't cast shit.
The other thing is...
That seems oppressive, actually.
Yeah, I mean, that's how we used to play aggro control. You'd play like Troll Ascetic, and you'd throw some equipment on him and just play counterspells.
Right. Now, the other thing is with the mana bases that green can do, especially with Sylvan Caryatid, Sultai Charm can fit in that deck too as a sideboard, because you're only switching out one color, right?
I like Sultai Charm a lot.
It's very powerful.
All the modes are so good.
Yeah, I'm going to be really interested because I think, you know, every time a new set comes out, we look at the set and we say, oh, this is really cool. This guild is supposed to do this, or this wedge is supposed to do this. And in the end, people don't exactly play the theme, right? They just play the most powerful cards, right?
They're going to take Rakshasa Death Dealer and stick it in a fucking Jund deck and not innovate. That's what's going to happen.
Well, that's what I'm like. Look at the red-white. You look at the red-white-green Elspeth decks that were very strong at the Block Pro Tour. I mean, people will jam a couple new cards in there and play those decks, and they'll be very good because they just still have the raw power of going turn three, Xenagos, turn four, Elspeth. And then, you know, people are going to be trying to make these new cards work, and they're going to be trying to play on theme, and it's just not going to get there. Right. So, you know, you just have to keep in mind that they build all these, you know, guilds, clans, wedges, whatever you want to call them, and they build them with their own thing. They want this to play out like this. And then you look at Constructed, and it's more like one or two cards make it and go into an already existing shell.
Right. Until rotation comes to where this is the first set, and then they're going to have to change things, right?
Right. Mm-hmm. At which point the cards in this set may have already been crowded out by cards in the next three sets. So.
Right.
But I think, regardless, whether people are building around the new wedges or the old wedges, I think Rakshasa Death Dealer is going to be a real player.
What yeah. about Flying Crane Technique? This card is just all kind of awesome.
It's a 6-mana cute spell. Yeah. I don't know.
It's just limited bomb. That's
it. Yeah, that card is going to be annoying and limited. Like, printed, I'm not looking forward to losing to someone who is awful who is playing that.
They've printed enchantments to do this for the same mana cost.
It's Overrun. So.
It's very good. Overrun was very good and limited and almost never playable constructed.
Yeah.
Because it gave the creatures +3/+3.
So, okay, one more I think that may be worth talking about. And I've seen some people get really big on this card. Hardened Scales. It's a one green enchantment that if one or more counters to be put on something, you instead add an additional one counter. And I've seen some people really excited about it. What do you guys think?
EDH only.
Oh, I don't think it's good in EDH at all, unless it's a combo piece.
Unless it's in Vorel or like any other deck that uses counters.
Sure. Now, there could be a green-white deck that does something with Heroic, and when it starts putting counters on stuff, you're just doubling up, right?
Right, that's the idea. Well, no, it doesn't double. It adds one more.
Doubles if you're going to add one.
Right. I don't know.
I'm a Vorel player. This is going in Vorel.
I mean, that sounds great for EDH, sure. I was talking Standard.
I think it'll take some work to get it to work in Standard. If it does, it could be powerful, but it's one of those decks that would probably last for a week or two and then just fade away.
I mean, like the Mono White Heroic deck was kind of a deck of the Pro Tour. I'm sure it'd be easy enough for it to splash green and play this, maybe. Mm-hmm. That's the only thing I can see. But even then, you just draw these and not creatures. I don't know. I'm not seeing it a lot.
So what about Empty the Pits? This is supposed to be the finisher of finishers, and everyone's supposed to be...
Wasn't that called Army of the Damned?
Army of the Damned is 10 times better than this card.
Army of the Damned's not an instant.
You're not going to... Yeah, great. You're not going to play this over Army of the Damned in the formats where Army of the Damned is legal. So, like, is this going to get played in Standard?
One of in those control decks, man. That's basically the only thing it could happen, right?
Yeah, they were saying that this is going to be a Standard player and you will be playing this card.
That's what I'm saying. Like, if you have these, think of how many, like, your Sphinx's Revelation decks from last season. I mean, some of those decks won with, like, Immortal of Immortality. Elixir of Immortality, right? Like, maybe you throw one of these in there and you just make 20 zombies on turn 30 instead.
I guess the quad black won't matter by the time you're ready to cast this.
And we got Urborg. Yeah. We do have Urborg in the right. set.
We do have Urborg. It's like a one of only, maybe.
Yeah. It was the next coming to Christ, and I don't know.
I mean, we're kind of hating on it just because it costs a million mana and all this stuff. In those control mirrors, I mean, it's an instant speed. You win the game.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's not irrelevant, but it's relevant in a very small percentage of matchups.
Yeah, I want someone to prove me wrong on this card and then prove it first before I even play with this card.
Is it just me, or is Meandering Tower Shell designed for M15?
Which one's that? The turtle?
The one that has pseudo phasing. Yeah, it's like, it's so slow at walking, it can only participate in combat every other turn. That's great.
I love
whatever
this card for moral purposes.
Web comic writer or D&D game creator or iPhone app guy that designed this fucking card. It's cool that it's super flavorful, but man, they should have put this in M15 where it belonged, where we had bad cards that were flavorful.
I love this card.
Island Walk is actually very
relevant.
That's
because you meander.
You can hit hit three of the five guilds, protection and any land walk.
Oh my gosh.
That's right.
Sure. You can attack them for five on turn six.
Hey, I'm not saying.
No, I'm sorry.
Turn seven.
You can attack them for five on turn seven.
I wish you'd put me out a turn faster with Caryatid. I'm a tower shell.
What happens when somebody like puts it on top of your deck and you're like, you wait three turns from now.
Three turns are gonna take five, maybe.
I'm thinking since it can only attack like once every two turns, the cost should have been lower.
Yes.
You know? Three or something, right?
It is a
but
five,
it's got nine,
nine
toughness, man.
Yeah. It's a
you play this and you open this up in limited and you just slam it and you're like, I'm never attacking. I dare you to attack me.
Right. Right.
I don't know, there's like cool things you can do, like, you know, attack with it, the Wrath.
That's what we're doing.
Or next turn you can pre-combat Wrath and then still be able to get an attack in.
That's what we're doing.
Or like, play Doran. Play this.
I'm not saying it's
Doran
good, but it's relevant.
He checks for 9 with Doran out.
Yeah, every 2 turns.
You only need to swing for 9 once.
Yeah, on turn like 4 with Abzan Ascension and win the game.
Speaking of Doran, did you see that Jacob Van Loonen said Mardu Ascendancy in a Doran deck? You can get him on like turn 3.
That's what I'm saying. It's a turn 4 kill. No, you're right. It is turn 3, I think. Yeah, it's like
that. You get the Noble Hierarch, the Doran, and the 2 tokens.
Yeah.
And you sack that for 12 extra damage.
Okay.
It's bannable, man. You're not allowed to win on turn 3 in modern.
Bannable.
we gotta end the podcast and you gotta start brewing. That's the end of it.
Yeah.
That's JVL deck, man.
Well, Dustin, thank you very much for coming on, man.
Yeah. Thanks for inviting me.
Where can people reach you at, if they want to find more Dustin?
GP Shizuoka's in January. Anybody can go, right?
Sure.
I know I'll be there.
And what esteemed podcast are you part of?
Spike Feed.
All right. But tune in next week for more Brainstorm Brewery and, send all hate mail to brainstormbrew@gmail.com. And we're out of here. Adios.
Goodbye.
Brainstorm Brewery is brought to you by GatheringMagic.com and CoolStuffInc.com. Show your support.